Let's go to the big house.
KCLR.
A series exploring the families and events of Carlow's old gentry houses.
Milford is a beautiful, picturesque place that nestles the River Barrow between weirs and bridges. There's a big mill on the corner of one of these bridges that really captures the attention. But it would be easy enough to miss the big house.
I'd walk along the canal and I'd see the back of the house here through the trees, and I can remember as a child being endlessly curious about the mill, and you know, you just got the sense that something important happened here.
The mill and the house are inextricably linked through the history of the Alexander family, who have lived for over 200 years at Milford House. But just who are the Alexanders?
The Alexanders had come over as settlers in the Ulster Plantation in the 1600s. They settled first in Donegal and they gradually moved east over to Derry, so that by the end of the 1700s they were settled in Belfast. Now, the father of the first man who came down, he was a merchant in Belfast, and he dealt in linen and timber, and he had a shipping company. And he was also the land agent to Lord Donegal, who was one of the biggest landlords in the country at the time. He had over 20,000 acres.
So they were an entrepreneurial family with a good nose for business, and they were willing to travel.
Carlow at that time was definitely on the up. It was becoming the centre of the corn industry in Ireland, not only because the land was so good, but because of legislation from the government. I mean, there was a piece of legislation called the Inland Bounties Act, 1758. And basically what that did was it gave any miller extra money for transporting their goods up to Dublin by road or by canal. So John Alexander came down here to Carlow. He spotted this little mill here in Ballygown, as it was known at that time. It was owned by a Catholic businessman called James Connolly, and he saw great potential there. And he decided, I want to be part of that. He set up a co-partnership with Connolly in 1784, and he gradually became the dominant partner in that arrangement. And he had a huge vision for the area.
Shay Kinsella is a native of Milford and is completing his PhD at the moment on the Alexander family and Milford Mills.
I think Milford House and Estate, it's an absolute goldmine of information, and it's a direct link with the past that attracts me most to the house and the family and the story of the business and the estate. You know, the fact that there have been five direct unbroken generations of the Alexander family here since 1784. I mean, to have that direct link, that continuity of the past, it's very attractive for a historian. And I mean, the Alexanders are only one of three gentry families in the county to still live in their ancestral home. So in that sense, the story brings you from a bygone age right up to the present.
So I think the best thing, I'll walk you around the whole house now.
I go to meet the present John Alexander at Milford House.
My secretary arrives shortly.
Okay.
She's 82 and been here all her life.
Are you serious?
Shay claims he is the fifth of the Milford line.
He gives out to me every time I say that he's the fifth, because he's not actually the fifth. He's probably the seventh or the eighth John Alexander in direct succession. But the way I use the numbers is in terms of the family here at Milford.
I think we're very lucky because it's of its type. It's not too big a house and easily managed. And I think it's a lovely house.
It's beautiful. Are they dear?
No. That is a famous thing. That's an Irish oak. They're 10,000 years old.
We're in the hallway of the house, which was built in 1799 by the first Milford, John Alexander. He had been living in a thatched house for many years while building up his milling business. Then he started courting a lady from Kells and needed a home of social standing.
The first John Alexander who came here was an employer for 20 years. I mean, he had no land to his name for 20 years. So most of the people around the area knew him primarily as a miller, as a local employer, as a businessman. The house was built within sight and within earshot of Milford Mills, you know, the industry that had funded it. Mm. And if you look at the outside of it, I mean, externally, it's quite simple. It's quite plain. It's a rectangular block, two stories above a basement. It doesn't have any of the carved stonework of Burris House or Dunleckney Manor. It has no statues like Duckett's Grove, no pediments like Oak Park or Clogrennan. And this was very deliberate. You know, he had the money. He had buckets of it to spare, actually, but he didn't feel the need to compete with the landed gentry.
It was the house of a miller, who was his own architect, by the way, rather than one of the landed gentry. It cost 15,000 to build from brick, which was unusual in those days, and underwent only one modest extension.
I've seen plans for an elaborate extension, but then the money ran out, so they had to build this bit. It's quite practical. Yeah. Thank God they did. There's billiard rooms and smoking rooms and all the usual things. It's a very practical house, I find.
So, yeah, this is the entrance hall, Monica, and as you can see, very high ceilings, about 14 feet high, and this is the very...
Back inside the house, myself and Shay chat under the watchful eyes of dead deers and other game.
Stuffed heads, you can see the stuffed game, the foxes, the deers, and a lot of that is the hunting trophies of Major John Alexander III, and he hunted across several continents. He was in Africa, he was in Asia, he was in America.
Major John III is one of the legends of the family.
He was out in Zululand, he was in the Zulu War. The boss of the British Army was General Wolsey from Mount Wolsey Tullow. And I don't think John Alexander, who was a lieutenant, and he got on very well. And my grandfather was sent off with a bunch of African scouts who rode bareback horses. He was in a smart English cavalry regiment. Anyway, the photograph is in the hall of him escorting Hetweo back after the final battle of Yolande.
It's a sketch from the centre pages of the Graphic newspaper in London, and it shows a young soldier here on horseback at the back, and that's actually Major John Alexander III. He was only, 29? He found himself in the middle of a war in Africa, and he really distinguished himself. He was part of the regiment that captured the last king of the Zulus, and he's commemorated then in this sketch, and no wonder it's here in the hall. He was obviously very proud of that moment.
It's amazing that two Carlo men were involved in this British victory and the loss of the Zulu nation's independence, and in the story of the King Hetweo's spear.
So the king himself had three ceremonial spears that were about 5 feet high. So they were taken from him as trophies of the battle. And one of them was to be given to Queen Victoria, one of them was to be given to Garnet Wolseley, and the third one was supposed to go to the British Museum. But John Alexander's servant, or his batman as it were called, he whispered into his master's ear, he said, "Don't be too surprised about what you find in your luggage." And when John Alexander came home, he found that the third spear, according to family tradition, was in his pack. So he was very proud of his role in the Zulu War, and he decided, well, I'm going to hold on to this for myself. And it has been here ever since, controversially or not, and it's still here.
But there was talks of it being brought back to South Africa.
In the days when Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa, there were talks about how appropriate it might be for the spear to be returned to the Inkatha party, which would have been the descendants of the Zulus. And actually, John Alexander here himself would have been quite willing to enter into negotiations there, but somebody on the African side was a little bit dubious about the heritage of the spear, and he wasn't sure if it really had been Hetweo. So I suppose happily for the Alexanders, that controversy died down and it's still here.
Still in the house, somewhere.
I can't find the spear. I think it's fallen behind the drawer there. I must try and get it.
The current John Alexander is very fond of his grandfather, John III.
I remember him well. He lived here till 1944, all through the war. And he was quite a character. He was in India, and he got bored being in the British Army. And he went, dressed himself up as a monk, and he was a small little fellow, and he went in to Tibet. He was the second white man to go into Tibet. Oh, he had a good life. Tough little man, though.
We'll get back to Major John as he became later, because if not, we are in danger of skipping too much of the house's history, as the family experienced huge ups and downs.
A number of factors kind of worked together to pull the rug from under their prosperity in terms of milling. The first thing was that the John Alexanders who succeeded their father, the founder of the mills, none of them really had his vision or his ability in terms of business. So when he died in 1843, there was really nobody to take over the helm here and to guide things, and especially in challenging economic circumstances. So that was the first reason. The second reason then was the Corn Laws were repealed in 1846, so that foreign flour from America and from Russia was being imported in its millions of tons. And I mean, Milford found it really, really hard to compete with that. Now, it didn't totally destroy it altogether, but the profit base definitely declined exponentially. And as well as that, then, the second generation of Alexanders here, they really didn't invest in the machinery of the mills. Most mills at that stage were converting to steam, and they decided to keep with the old water power. And by the 1860s, they were definitely on a downward slope. Mm. And this was compacted then by the massive fire in the mill in 1862 in November in the flour mill.
It caught fire. See, they had all these grindstones for grinding stuff, and I suppose one of them caught fire. But by that time, the thing was not very successful.
Apparently, it was sparked off by one of the grinding stones. A spark caught a sack on fire, and within a couple of hours, the whole place was an inferno. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine now, but the whole place was just wrecked. I mean, there's accounts of workmen going in there, desperately trying to save the building, trying to save their jobs, their clothes going on fire and having to be brought back outside and being rolled over to put out the fire on their clothes. The place was just wrecked. All of the floors, all seven floors, collapsed within a couple of hours. It was a devastating blow, not just for the Alexanders, but for the local economy. I mean, there was 100 men employed in the works, and a good chunk of those would have been employed in the flour mill.
My family went from... We just hung on.
But there was a malt house that was still functional.
The malt house, there was a massive malt house there beside the flour mill. I mean, there were two massive buildings. And the mill building that survives today was actually the smallest of the three buildings. And the malt house was the largest by far. I mean, it was 222 feet long. It was the biggest malt house by far in Ireland, the most profitable. And its products were so good that Arthur Guinness actually commissioned the Milford Malt House to exclusively supply his Guinness brewery in Dublin with prime quality malt from the 1830s onwards.
But a legal dispute with the original founder of the mill, James Connolly, saw the Alexander family lose control of the malt house in 1870. They were then left with only one mill, the Strongstream Mill, and, of course, the land.
What they had left then was the landed estate, 2,000 acres, and it became their main source of income at that stage.
But then there was light, literally.
This is one of the first houses all in the world to be lit by electricity, yes.
Back in those days, remember, there was no electricity.
They didn't have any electricity, so they had to light fires and light candles.
Like, there's no TV or iPads or phones or anything.
Their toys were not electric. They only had, like, dolls and toys with wheels and cars.
The girls from second class in St. John of God, Kilkenny, find this hard to get their heads around.
I think it would have been very dark.
What was missing?
It's really about, like, switches, and they didn't have any.
But this is where one man had the solution. James Gordon, a young English electronic engineer.
In 1891, Mr. Gordon, who's a big engineer in England, went on to be a big turbine producer, arrived over, made a deal with my grandfather, the little fellow over there, and installed hydroelectric turbines.
It had become Major John's responsibility to revolutionise the family fortunes and create something from the remaining mill. And he had many ideas.
He was a very progressive thinker himself, a real innovator in these parts. And by 1890, he was toying with the idea of opening up a cooperative creamery in the mill for the benefit of the local tenants and the local farmers. And he actually invited Horace Plunkett, who was pushing this idea of cooperation in Irish agriculture, to come down and speak to the local farmers. And he did. He came down and from Dublin, and he gave a talk in the old mill. And that creamery did eventually start up, and it was very successful for a while. So that was Major Alexander's idea for the mill.
That was until he met the electric light lads.
Actually, in one of the Major's diaries, there's a little brief entry in November 1890, which reads, "Going into Carlow to interview the electric light lads." So, I mean, he said, "Look, I'll go and meet these boys and see what they have to say to me." And he was very taken with their idea of breathing life into the disused Strongstream mill. And Gordon's proposal of installing an electrical turbine there.
He had a cable running up the river to Carlow. He spent 20,000 down there. It was not a success. In the winter, the floods, and the summer, there was no water. Mm-hmm. So when it worked, it was splendid because it did away with the old gas lighting in the streets. Right. And it was very popular. But when it broke down, it wasn't so popular.
Then in 1893, sadly, just 2 years after the electricity started to be generated, James Gordon died in a horse riding accident in England, and his company went bust. And Major Alexander snapped up the chance then of becoming an electrical entrepreneur in his own right.
My grandfather got engineers from England to build a diesel plant, bump, 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 by the rowing club. And he went down and electrified the whole of the town. And I've got the books here still of the accounts of it. And that was quite successful up to 1926. The ESB came along and nationalised it, closed it down. Meanwhile, the machines were down here. To make a long story short, I spent an awful lot of money renovating this and eventually putting in a big modern turbine, which I've got down there now. And I sell that into the national grid, which is quite a big thing. With the knowledge I learned from here, I went down to the McLacuddy's Reeks, and I made a super scheme down there, very profitable, 1,000-foot drop at a pipe, 14-inch pipe. So that's my electrical side of it.
John has many sides to himself and has led an interesting life.
Well, I was brought up in Limerick a lot because we had the foxhounds, and I was in the British Army for a bit. I was in Berlin when the airlift was, and the Russians were being difficult, but I left the army. I ended up in California looking after horses. Mm-hmm. A rather eccentric lady who I had to escort to a dinner party one night in Hollywood. And I sat next to Mrs. James Mason, and there was Joseph Cotton, Paulette Goddard. It was given by Joan Fontaine. And a very nice American was there. He said, "I want to buy a horse farm in Ireland." And I said, "I'm your man." So I bought a horse farm in Kilcock, which I ran for him for 20 years. I had a great time. And then my mother had the same thing. She had horses down here.
John's mother was a well-known Carlow lady and a character.
She was born Olive Hall in 1905, and she was the daughter of Mrs. Hall, who was Carlow's famous female master for hounds. This lady married John Alexander IV in 1926, and she's significant in Milford's story because she was the only Alexander wife to run the show here after her husband died quite young in 1961. And she ran the famous Milford Stud Farm. She was passionate about horses and fox hunting all her life until she died in 1980. And they were areas in which she had a legendary status. I mean, everybody knew Mrs. Alexander. She was actually the last master of the Carlow Hunt before it disbanded in the 1960s. And she was remembered by many locals for her sense of style, particularly when she was attending the races. But she was also a very formidable lady. She took no nonsense, and she's actually remembered by many locals for her insistence on being called Madam. Oh, yeah. When you were speaking to her.
She's like her mother then, because the original Mrs. Hall was quite a lady, wasn't she too?
Absolutely. She was a force to be reckoned with. Absolutely no nonsense. And she was just a powerhouse in terms of Carlow sport and Carlow hunting, and widely respected, a close friend of the Queen Mother in England. And they were definitely a no-nonsense family. She was coming back from one of her hunts at one stage, and her groom was taking the horse into the stable, and he said, "Oh, madam, your horse is sweating. He's sweating very heavily, or too heavily almost." And she came back with a quip, said, "Of course he's sweating. Wouldn't you be if you were lodged between my thighs for 2 hours?"
There's nothing like having a history of strong-minded ladies in the family tree.
This is Mrs. Ethel Alexander, and she died in 1916. She was the wife of the third John Alexander, Major Alexander. And the reason I'd point her out is because she was Carlow's first female district councillor.
Her portrait, along with all the other family portraits, are hung in the dining room of Milford House.
Everything in the history of the house and the community and the family would have been discussed here at this table at one point over breakfast or dinner. I often like to think that I'd love to have been a fly in the wall to eavesdrop on family conversations down through the centuries. I'd love to hear, for example, you know, the talk at the table after John Alexander II became an MP, which was a huge boost for the family and for the area.
The Alexanders, like many wealthy families at the time, were keen to dabble in politics.
The Alexanders, once they made their money in the mills, they would have always been eager to boost their profile. And one of the main ways of doing that would have been to get down and dirty during the election campaigns and to help the main Tory landlords of the county. And that's pretty much how the Alexander profile was boosted in the mid-1800s. Unfortunately, that went a little awry during the 1830s when they became a little too Tory, a little too aggressive to their tenantry. They were kind of trying to enforce force their opinions on their tenantry locally. And in 1835, that created a lot of problems for the local tenants here. And there was a lot of controversy, a lot of violence on the estate. But that passed by the 1850s and things became a lot more peaceful.
The MP John Alexander's portrait hangs in the dining room.
Dining, of course, would have been a very formal process in previous centuries. And there was a very clear distinction, as you know, between master and servant. So a bell would have been used here on the dining tables. And actually, that was used right up until the 1970s.
There is people who were servants and they take care of the king and queen.
In the nursery, when they're in there, like, the servants mind them and the mummies and daddies are down, like, on the couch and they, like, do sewing and knitting and stuff like that.
And the maids didn't go the same way as everybody else. They went secret doors and secret stairs.
Only the family and the guests could use the main door into the house. There's only one main door into the house under the portico. So all the servants, the tradesmen, you know, the other staff, they used the service entrance or the office door into the basement.
And so we take off to the basement.
Yeah, so as you can see, Monica, we're in the basement now. Totally different to upstairs. You can hear the echo. You can feel the cold. You can see the flagged floors. This is very much the hub of the work of the house. The headquarters down here. No fancy wallpaper, no plastering. And every room down here would have served a practical work purpose. So there's a wine cellar, there's a scullery, there's a pantry, a boot room, a servants' hall. And then there would have been separate bedrooms then for the male and the female staff. So in many ways, the servants who made the whole house tick here are, you know, the silent parties in Milford House's history.
But there was one servant lady who is celebrated within the family. Her name was Annie Rowntree, and she was the cook.
As you know, the cook was a senior member of staff in any big house, but in Milford she was the senior member of staff, without a doubt, and she combined the role of cook and housekeeper. And it was the done thing for the landed gentry in Ireland to get their senior staff from England. In fact, of the 9 servants who were here in 1901, only 3 of them were from Carlow. All the indoor and the outdoor staff, as I said, would have met in here, the gardeners, the gamekeepers, and they were all ruled by this formidable lady, Miss Annie Rowntree. And you can imagine her here giving out orders in her strong Yorkshire accent. The present John Alexander remembers her well. As a little boy, he would have come down to the basement, and you were very much entering her territory if you came into her kitchen. She was extremely efficient, loyal, caring to the family, actually. Now, I think a great sign of her attachment to the family and to Milford can be seen today in the fact that she wanted to be buried here in the local Protestant cemetery at Clyde, very close to the Alexander family plot. And out of loyalty and gratitude to her for her remarkable period of service, the Alexanders erected a lovely headstone over her grave. And I think it has a really warm inscription, and it reads, "In love and memory of Annie Rowntree, for 50 years, the faithful friend of the Alexander family."
So, from well-loved cooks to Zulu King spears and electricity to horse breeding, Milford House has seen it all and is a living monument to the past.
So, for me, Milford House is basically a repository of 2 centuries of local history. Of course, there were a landlord family, a big house, an estate with tenants and servants and privileges, but the history of Milford is also the history of the local community itself, who created this wealth and this success for the Alexanders. I mean, the family didn't grind their corn by hand by themselves. So the story of Milford is also the story of numerous tenants, labourers, millers, maltsters, gardeners, clerks, coachmen, servants, nannies. You know, all of these people contributed to the success of Milford, which is, it's ongoing. So I think we can take pride in it, and we should take pride in it, and we should look on it as a shared history of the community, and we should promote it and celebrate it.
KCLR.
Let's go to the big house. Produced by Monica Hayes and funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.